which was crucial because what we wanted to do was to open up this estate and allow other people to come in and see another side to this life. That is what Big Art does. It takes the story from the fringes and brings it to the mainstream, and in doing so, challenges the perceptions that people have to those outsiders, whether they're single mothers, whether they're isolated Indigenous communities. And it's important that that story gets brought to the main stage and we challenge those preconceived ideas about what people think.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
We want to debate, investigate, and entertain.
Join us as we challenge the human experience
by speaking to people who impact the world through art. Chapter 2, Podcast 8, Christopher Saunders.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
First off, we would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders, past and present, on which this podcast recording today takes place.
And of course, it's March, the beginning of autumn, which I personally love, and time for Chapter 2, Podcast 8. Yay!
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, Nick, but I have felt a bit of a big shift personally since we last recorded. What's been on your mind?
Oh, a big shift. I don't know whether it's a big shift or a big omission that I've felt this month. I've noticed that there's a distinct lack of Nick Kane and Lauren Bailey at this year's Oscars ceremony. Have you noticed that? Lauren, it's a bloody crying shame.
Oh, what? I was there. I didn't see
you. Were you? Didn't think to send me an invite, obviously.
Awkward.
Awkward.
Well, let's see where we're at and what's happening for the month ahead and see if we can fix the Oscars issue for next year. How about that?
Yes, let's see if we can fix that. So my month has been obviously an interesting one, not going to the Oscars, but there's been other things going on in my life, and I've got a little topic that I wanted to talk about this month, which was around the importance of routine.
Aha.
As you know, Lauren, my life has been in full swing recently. I've got used to the Newcastle lifestyle. I have been making trips to Sydney for auditions, and sometimes that's meant, you know, same day turnaround. So, you know, I'll go to an audition in the morning and then I'll hear, hey, they want you back in the afternoon, and I'll jump back on that train and go back into Sydney.
Get out, really?
Yeah, yeah. So, look, it's not without its challenges, but it is working.
Living the life.
Living the life. So glamorous. What a rock star lifestyle. But one thing I have noticed is, and one thing I addressed this month was the idea of routine, because when you have a little one come into your life and there's other things going on like moving cities and so forth, everyone knows what's been going on in my life if they've been listening to the podcast, you really realize that you become quite reactive and routine is so important. So I sat down and I know you hear the word routine, right, Lauren, and you go, That sounds about as exciting as an accountancy Christmas party, which, just as a side note, accountancy Christmas parties, I think, can be pretty wild.
I know a few crazy accountants, just quietly.
So do I. That's,
I have a lot of fun.
Yeah, they worry me. But it is important, I think, routine, to mention this, is that you get routine so that you can have time for fun. That's what I've found, especially at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, I will plan my routine with all the things that it needs. So, you know, yes, I've got to give some time to Harper, to the dog, to family and chores. But also then you've got to get in your routine the artistic time that you have to use, your work time. You fill that schedule and then you make sure there's time for you. I think that's important that you don't lose that, because to me, my sense of playfulness and curiosity is key to me being a well-balanced performer and creative, right?
Absolutely. I think it's also important to be conscious of finding fun inside the routine as well.
That's right. Yes, 100%. But I think it is important to have the space and the ability to go, rightio, today's for me, or today is my opportunity to switch the brain off maybe a little bit and just have fun.
Oh, well, that sounds very exciting. It does sound like we've both been going through some big stuff.
Yeah.
Firstly, I'd like, in speaking about my month, I'd like to throw back to podcast 7, where we obviously interviewed each other and looked at the learnings from our own creative journeys, but also from the podcast so far. And it turned out this was actually a real gift for me in helping me to be clear on sort of where I am at this point in my journey and to sort through the things that I'm choosing to bring into my life. And I've been conscious of this need to focus and align exactly what that is that I'm working on and toward. And things have definitely, as I said, shifted since the last podcast in a big way that has had some positives come out of it.
Fantastic.
And I guess I say that because one of the things that I think really was the final catalyst for this shift that I've sort of been thinking around these things, and then something happened to make things even clearer for me. And that was that my wonderful grandmother passed away in February. Yeah,
very sorry to hear.
And I was very close to her, and it has been all of the things that someone you love passing away can be. Mm-hmm. And in looking forward again from that, it's helped me to consolidate the things that I really want to keep as part of my life and that I really do want to be working toward. We've got as much time as we have. What do we want to do with that time? And what can I let go of to let that happen? And I guess also part of that is coming together with family. So there's been some clarity on my career front, but also a real reconnection with my own family, who I'm very close to, and also a lot of our relatives.
I think when something like that so personal happens, it's amazing how it can just bring your focus to a laser level in regards to going, you know what, all this extra kerfuffle around me, you start to remember what's important, and it takes you back to your purpose in life. Once again, I'm sure your grandma was a massive supporter of what you did, and she's always going to be there with you, and it's such a lovely thing to be able to come together with family, align, and then move forward at such a tragic time, but move forward in a positive way.
Absolutely. And to give you the motivation that you need to deal with the big scary goals that you've set yourself for the year.
Yes.
And I think we'll talk about
big scary goals.
I think I'll talk more about how that has motivated me on the other side of the interview today.
Yeah, beautiful. And that is what we're going to do now. We're going to transition into the interview. And I couldn't be more excited to bring this man onto the podcast. He has been working wonders in my new hometown of Newcastle and, of course, across the globe. He is an arts and social change agent, a creative producer, and an actor. He is Christopher Saunders. Enjoy.
Welcome to the podcast, Christopher. And of course, we're currently sitting in your fantastic home studio, a place which you have built as a creative haven for your very talented playwright wife, Vanessa Bates. We've actually reappropriated her writing. Oh, yes. Should we? I should announce
that. You can
that.
Tell her oh, that. Okay. I will tell her that.
We've reappropriated the writing table for our own purposes, but we'll promise we'll put everything back where it came from. Moving right along, to start with, we'll get you to read your story for us, Christopher.
Okay, so my creative life has been accumulative. Everything I've done has contributed in some way to where I find myself now. It's a journey I'm enjoying very much. At the age of 10, I decided I'd like to be an actor. Well, I helped restore the theatre I was performing in at the time, and this served me well 40 years later when I restored an art house cinema here in Newcastle. When I went to university to do a BA in English, I spent all my time in the theatre and neglected my other studies. They were halcyon days. I supported myself working with an antique furniture restorer where I learnt the basics of carpentry. I made a few dining tables that I sold to fund a trip to the UK. I spent a year in London doing workshops and seeing as much live performance as I could afford. My professional career as an actor began in Perth when I was 21, Laertes in Hamlet, followed by numerous roles with a variety of theatre companies. And at 23, it was time to seek bigger opportunities in the East, Melbourne, then Sydney, agents, TV, miniseries, commercials, theatre, unemployment, subsidised by labouring, work and carpentry. I lived for 8 years in a warehouse in Surrey Hills before it was the trendy thing to do, and we ran a theatre company from there.
I remember once being down to my last $50, so I went out to spend it on dinner where I met someone who gave me a job. It's a good philosophy on how to live, I think. I was given the opportunity to build a house and thought I probably had the skills to do it, so I did. But I continued to audition and work as an actor when I could. Performing at night in the botanical gardens after a day on the tools was a challenge. I met Vanessa 23 years ago in the theatre in Newcastle when I was here as a jobbing actor. A Midsummer Night's Dream. She played Puck, I was Lysander. I guess she put a spell on me. I helped establish national arts organisation Big Art, where I worked for 15 years. The connection between story, community and the mainstream had a big impact on my creative approach. I had the opportunity to perform, to produce, manage budgets and work with numerous diverse communities and artists in cross-platform arts. Having a child and the responsibility that goes with that made me shift priorities around work-life balance. It also prompted the move to Newcastle when Tristan was ready to start school. This enabled the connection with Renew Newcastle and the opportunity to share my skill set there. I see myself as an enabler, creating opportunities for people to experiment with ideas. This is a diverse and rewarding role, but can be somewhat thankless at times. My own creativity needs to be fed, hence the desire to build a writing studio for Vanessa and to perform when I have the time and the play is right. The opportunity to activate the Newcastle station couldn't have come at a better time. I'm ready for this next adventure, and so is Renew Newcastle.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And this, of course, inspired a plethora of questions yes. in both of us, but we will...
Good.
So we have got a few things to get to. But firstly, what we both loved about your story is the obvious connection that you have between your creative pursuits and your need to restore and create places that support that passion.
So from when you were young and when you were restoring that first theatre, right through to your most ambitious restoration, which I think was the Regal Cinema, what excites you about the process of restoration and creativity still 40-odd years on?
I think it's the control that you have to be able to embark on something like that. And right. the when I say control, I mean the opportunity to do to follow an idea through, to make something happen largely from nothing. And I think that's a real key thing here. Because, look, building is very expensive. Mm-hmm. Tradesmen are now... very expensive. They're the nouveau rich. They are. I mean, and but when I started, it wasn't. It was something that you did to, you know, instead of me being a, you know, working bars or working a cafe. I've never done that. It was always getting on the tools, and the labouring with stuff was, you know, $20 an hour kind of stuff. But it was absorbing of how to do something, and that's why the whole, you know, build a house thing was like, this can't be that difficult. And a lot of people are really daunted by that. But it's really, you know, it's sort of about looking at what makes up a building, what makes up. It's about giving it the opportunity is there to give it a go, I think. And a lot of people, I mean, we see that with all these lifestyle shows that says, you know, you can do it and everyone, you know, can get in and have a go. But, you know, to sort of take the time and an effort to work out what is the right way to do something, I think is really important.
Especially with creative spaces, the feeling, I mean, we're sitting in your studio right now. You told us off air that this has almost all been built without a visit to the hardware store, that this has come about by you slowly over time building this up and putting the love into it so that it can be used by yourself and Vanessa as a creative space.
Well, look, there's a couple of things there. I mean, one, I'm appalled at the amount of stuff that gets thrown out. And so a lot of the stuff that came from here came from a building around the corner, a house that they tore the back off, which is the same age as our house here. And they were just going to chuck all that stuff out to the tip. In fact, I rang the demolition people and said, look, you know, you've got the weatherboards that are the same as my house. They're really hard to come by. They're 100 years old. You know, can I have some? And thankfully he said yes. And I went over there the days the truck, the semi-trailers arrived for them to load all this 100-year-old timber. That's 100-year-old when it was built, used to build. Yeah. So it's come from trees that's, you know, how many hundreds of years old? And they're going to go and use that for landfill. That appalls me.
Yeah.
So my challenge to build this was very much, can I do this without going to the hardware store? No, not possible. I obviously needed to get, you know, certain things, light fittings, and but I don't throw timber out. And there are bits of timber in this building that I've been carrying around for 20 years, you know.
Joy when you finally get to use it.
That's right. And I knew when I had that, you know, when that piece of timber came my way, I thought, this will be coming useful somewhere, you know. And again, it's like, what can you do? And there were days when I was building this when I go, I know the simple thing for me to do would be get out of the timber yard and go and buy that, but it's going to cost me $60. What have I got here that I can use to make that? So I did that a lot of times in here.
It's interesting. I mean, there's some great themes there around sustainability. Also, I just love this idea of creating places that will then have stories inside of them, whether that's a house that you live in or obviously a studio where someone's writing, but that they're encapsulating stories. Anyway, that's
So this place is full of stories. So, I mean, I could walk you around here and point to everything in here and tell you the story of it, the person who gave it to me, or, you know, how I use that, you know, and that is, you're so right. And this is a place that Vanessa writes stories, so that sense of story.
Yeah, you can feel it coming in here, absolutely.
And Vanessa said that when she came in here, she said, darling, this is really a really lovely place to work. I like being here. Oh. And I just thought at this time when she's got a hugely, you know, big year on, she's coming out here in the morning now, and she just, you know, I get up and she's not in the house, and I know she's out here. It's great.
Yeah, I've got a place in Mayfield in Newcastle that needs a creative spark, if you're willing.
Yeah, they're looking for some work.
Yeah, but you know, like I think the number of hours that went into this. Yeah, right.
So the other thing I love about the way you talk about building this, it just really reminds me of what you said about your life philosophy.
Yeah.
That you touched on, and I just, please, 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 I would like you to share with us how we can turn $50 into a job opportunity.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people get very fearful. One of the things, and you know this, you've worked in the hand-to-mouth creative as actors, performers, you know, it makes it easier for us in the world that we live in now where there is no job for life. But I think, you know, 30 years ago, when there was still expectation that you'd have a job for life, and I think there still is, not so much with the younger generation, but that is no... I'm no
It's much more widely accepted now.
This job I have with Renew Newcastle is the first time I've been full-time employed, you know, beyond a contract to deliver a show or something like that. You know, I mean, I did have a year-long contract before with a theatre company many years ago, but really, you know, that was a means to an end. Yeah. But so to get to the age of 50 and then have your first... you know, employment.
Hi, Mum.
You know, that doesn't faze me too much. Yeah. And Vanessa and I talk about this all the time. You know, if we lose that job, what happens? Well, it will be okay.
We'll work it out.
So I think that comes back to that thing with the $50. And I'd forgotten all about that, but I was reminded of that by a friend of mine who's a musician who said, I'll never forget that time you were down to your last $50. And you said, let's go out to dinner. And we both went out together and spent that $50 and met somebody at that dinner who said, I'm looking for somebody to do some renovation on this building.
Yeah.
And we said, we can start Monday. And there we were. You know. And I thought, what a great, that is such a great thing to do, because the tendency might be to go, oh shit, you know, I'm down to $50. How long can I make this last? How long can I sort of squirrel this away and sit at home? Well, if you're sitting at home, you're not engaging, you're not open to anything. I had a similar story when I was in London. You know, I don't know how old I was, you know, mid-20s or something, late 20s. And I remember we were waiting to get a visa to go to the Soviet Union at the time, and we were depleting our savings. And I said to my partner at the time, I'm going out, I'm not coming back till I've got a job. But just saying that, put that,
you're in that frame,
you know, And it's sort
it's
of
a focus
it's about
rather
taking
than a
that
desperation.
Risk, and I think we forget to do that as creatives. Mm. We often go, yeah, I could do that, you know. Pick up the phone, make the call, and look, I don't do this all the time. I love to do this. I say, it's how I aspire to live, really. Right. Just take that chance, make the call, and back yourself.
Yep. I heard something a year or so ago about this idea of, and I've talked about it on the podcast before, I think, about being... choosing to be brave, and that it's one thing to choose to be brave one day and go, okay, I'm going to get rid of this job to pursue an acting career, but you actually need to choose that bravery every day.
You do, and you need to back yourself. And I think there's a tension here as well between, you know, just having the chutzpah to go and do that, but there's a lot of bullshit as well. People do a lot of bullshit, and you know, you see this. I think it's about knowing that you are up for the challenge, backing yourself and say, you know, I'm right for this, but don't oversell yourself. Don't bullshit. Do, you know, deliver what you say you can do. And I think that's really important to get that balance.
Yeah.
So let's turn the focus to acting now. You've been a jobbing actor for many years. What do you love about it? What keeps you coming back?
When I first started and when I was young, I sort of naively thought, you know, I could change the world. And I think that was the desire to do that. I think the turning point came for me in the early 90s when I was doing Home and Away.
Yeah.
And I had just done a show with a director who was very passionate about not changing the writer's words. And I don't think in Australia we're not very respectful still of the writer's work.
Great.
I'm married to a writer. Of course, you know, this was before that, though, you know, and I had this sense that we do need to, rather than improvising and doing our thing, how are you ever going to you know, maintain a structure, an arc, a narrative arc, you know, if you're not going to trust your writer. So I was doing Home and Away, having worked with this director who had not changed a word in this play that we'd done, which I felt needed a lot changed in it, but he made it work. And it was terrific, a terrific learning experience. So off I went to Home and Away and was given this line. I'll tell you this line because I think it was, I was playing...
Here we go.
You know, I was playing a character who'd been in jail and you know, was now sort of falling off the tracks again. I was
typecast again.
I was Justine Clarke's boyfriend. She was playing Rue. This is the year it was. Yeah. And it was at a time. And you know, Justine was fantastic. And I was new to television as well. I mean, I was very familiar with theatre, but not the TV thing. And, you know, I was being set up for you know, to get done again, and I was going to possibly get in trouble and get sent back to jail. And I was talking to Rue in the cafe about a guy who someone I'd witnessed being beaten up in jail. And the line was, that animal turned him into a vegetable. I can't go back in there, Rue. I can't go back. Now, Justine said to me, just change it, just change it. And I said, no. I've been working with this director. We can make that work. Yeah. You can't make that work. I challenge you. Anyway, I mean, that was just one, you know, one little story. But I felt at the time, I thought, you know, this is not changing the world. This is not what I felt it got me into this. And then it was then I sort of started working with Big Art and that whole, you know, the beginning of that idea. And I thought, this is amazing, that you can use theatre, live performance, as a way to challenge people because you're having a shared experience. You've got a group of people all in a space together. And I think, not like film, but I think that the experience in a movie cinema is different. I think you have your own individual experience, but I think in the theatre you have a shared experience. And there's an opportunity, therefore, for people to be changed, for behaviour change to happen, for those profound aha moments can happen, or that collective moment can happen with an audience. And that's what excites me. And so that's why I say I'm very picky about what I do these days, because it's not just about, for me, the challenge of doing a great role. Yes, that's part of it. But what is this play about? What is relevant about this work that we're doing that could make a difference in the world that we're living in? And I think that's what makes me want to be part of the arts in general, you know, whether that's an actor or whether that's, you know, doing whatever we do.
And isn't that the joy of experience, that you do get to the point where you know the stories that you want to be involved in and the things that you want to be saying? So social change, I mean, it's essential to us as storytellers as well, and one of the reasons that we're really excited to talk to you today. And it's great that you brought up your role at Big Heart, which is an organisation tackling disadvantage in isolated communities, which sounds like it required all of your creative skills, acting, production and project management more than that. How do you feel that working at Big Heart informed your creative approach, in particular the way you view story and community?
The beauty of it was that I started largely as a performer with that organisation. I mean, the organisation was very much in its infancy at the time. Scott Rankin, who's the artistic director, you know, asked me to come down as an actor, but I knew that would involve running some workshops. And very quickly, I realised that here was an opportunity. I mean, I think what Big Art gave me was this philosophy to work where you create opportunities for people. And my whole philosophy now is about, you know, you want to do something? Great. How can I assist you to make that happen? Yeah. You're going to do it, but how can we remove the obstacles that are preventing you from doing that? And I think that's what Big Art did.
Can you give us a really quick example of what Big Heart does, a project they might have done, so the listeners can understand exactly what they're all about and I guess how it comes to life?
There is amazing stories in our community that are hidden on the fringes that we don't often get to hear about. I worked for 5 years, maybe even 7 years, in Surry Hills, in the public housing estate, the Northcote public housing estate. Now, in that building, which was built post-war, opened in 61, and housed people from the diaspora, from the war, from a lot of people from Europe, it was a project in social housing back then, where these modern apartment blocks were built, and it was one of the first in Australia, I think, and certainly the largest in the Southern Hemisphere. It started off with great intents, but quickly spiraled into not a, a great social experiment from that perspective. Yet there were people who had lived there from the 60s, who we got to meet. Now, at the time we started that project, the space was known as Suicide Towers. There were regular suicides from people jumping off the building. There was drug dealers. There was a massive dismemberment murder, triple murder. Was it a triple murder? I'm not sure exactly. That happened, which was going to hit the news the day that two planes flew into the Twin Towers in the US.
Yeah.
So that didn't get the traction that it would have got. But this was a dangerous place as it was perceived in the media. Lots of negative stories. And there it was in the heart of Sydney. And there it was opposite Belfast Street Theatre. So to start there, we went, here is a theatre company that is a renowned theatre company in Australia with this wealth of story across the street. And we knew there was a wealth of story there because we had our key workers, a guy called Dominic Greno, was working for Department of Housing at the time as a community development worker. And he said, you should come in here. And he was a friend, you know, colleague. You should come and work here. There's a great project here. There is enormous story. 1,200 people living there. But the stories we were hearing about in the media were the nasty ones, the suicides, the drug dealings, the arrests, the whatever, you know, the murders. And we wanted to scratch the surface and see what was underneath there. And, of course, this wealth of story. So the challenge then became, how do we shift the perceptions of the broader community about what is actually here? Because it's too easy. So this is the behavioural change. You know, bloody houses, scum, you know, the only time that the patrons of the theatre knew anything about the Northcote when they came back to return to their cars after a lovely night in the theatre and it had been broken into and some asshole had, you know, stolen it from the houses, you know. Yeah. Now, that's not really the story we felt that was there. Yes, there's an element of that. It's and the there are many reasons. That's the one that the media takes. Yeah. There are many reasons for that. The Olympic Games and the cleaning up the streets of Sydney and let's, you know, make the priority housing, those the homeless and, you know, the disenfranchised and so, and without many supports. So it has a big impact upon that community. So, look, this is a massive project. But what I'm getting at is that you start working with people there, and we would go in and we'd initially start door knocking, say hello to people, we'd sit down, can we have a cup of tea? And we'd have a cup of tea with people. And then somebody else might walk past in the corridor and say, have you met so-and-so? Why don't you, you know, have them come in for a cup of tea? And then they would start to talk with each other and say, do you mind, you know, you keep talking, we'll leave. And so it was this kind of cup of tea approach to introducing people and creating community. That was the beginning, right?
Yeah.
And then we started doing things outdoors and running barbecues, and people would come up and, what's going on here? Oh, well, we're gathering stories and, you know, we're getting involved. We've got a photographer involved. Get involved with this photographic project. You know, tenants are taking photographs of each other.
Yeah.
We're recording stories. We have an idea that we're going to create a show for Belfast Street, which is what we were going to do. Look, that didn't end up working for the theatre, although the show was written.
But I'm sure a million...
Their season. But we got it into the Sydney Festival, which was really key to do. And the reason we got it into the Sydney Festival is because I took a whole series of these beautiful portraits that have been taken, tenant by tenant, it was called, pictures of tenants by other tenants, which were mentored by a professional photographer.
Awesome.
My brother, Keith Saunders, plug, who was terrific, you know. But the director, Fergus Lineham, of the festival at the time, saw these images and said, this is amazing. This is the story. Yeah. Let's hear this story. And so we got this show on at the Sydney Festival,
awesome.
Which was crucial because what we wanted to do was to open up this estate and allow other people to come in and see another side to this life. Mm. That is what Big Art does. It takes the story from the fringes and brings it to the mainstream, and in doing so, challenges the perceptions of people that people have to those outsiders, whether they're single mothers, whether they're isolated Indigenous communities, and it's important that story gets brought to the main stage, and we challenge those preconceived ideas about what people think. So that is an amazing place to work, and there are amazing opportunities to explore many different avenues of story. As I quickly became a producer, and wore many hats and did, and I sort of mentioned to you earlier about, you know, how far do you keep upskilling yourself? I chose not to learn film editing at the time because I thought my head is full and there's somebody else who we should bring on to do that.
And the project management thing, you start to get a point where you become good at everything, this utility person where you go, oh, I can just do that, and you pick up another skill, and oh, I can just do that, and you pick up another skill, and before you know it, you're probably overburdening yourself.
This is where the enabling stuff comes in. Find the expert. Find the person who really wants to do that. You want to be a filmmaker? Here's an opportunity to come and be a filmmaker. Come and do that. Work with this community. And in doing so, what we've got to manage very carefully there is the attitude towards the people we're working with. They're not clients. They're participants. Yes. You know, they're people whose story we want to tell. And we want to value those people.
Correct.
And so we become about enabling those people as much as we are the artists who are having the opportunity to work with them. So it is participatory arts, and I think that's the key word. It's everyone participating. It's the artist participating. It's the community participating, and it's all about valuing the story that the participant has. And there is amazing stories that, particularly with the disenfranchised, stories of survival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Working with teenage kids who'd fallen out of education, who were on the cusp of being, you know, incarcerated or involved with juvenile justice. But these have been failed by the system. The school didn't want to know about them anymore. They were the truancy kids. They were the ones hardest to work with. But the wealth of story from these kids who survive on a daily basis, and it is a daily basis. How am I going to eat today? How am I going to get by? Maybe I'll nick something, whatever. But the life skills of those individuals is extraordinary and much greater than the one that my son has, who's 11, because it has to be. They don't realise that they have this wealth of story and knowledge. Our job then is to try and, you know, encourage them so that their life trajectory can shift, yeah. Their career trajectory, if career is even on the radar, yeah. Can shift for them to become included.
Yeah, this is more a side note than a question, but just from the last few stories you've told us, I just keep thinking there's this idea that we listen to people to create art, and the outcome is fantastic and achieves all of the things that the outcome achieves. But just this initial first act of listening to people, and it made me think of when we spoke to Sue Maslin a couple of months ago, and she talked to the women in the Women's Land Army who had sat on their experiences for decades, and it was for a documentary, and these women for the first time would have the opportunity to talk and often end in tears. And yeah, it sounds like the same thing that you're
bringing
up here. And
so they don't think
they've
got a story, you know.
Yeah.
You come in and you talk to somebody, I want to hear your story. I've got a good story, you know. I worked with farming families in the Murray-Darling Basin who were suffering the massive drought, and it was all about water. Tell us your story. Oh, I'm going to have a story to tell. And then, you know, it takes time and you realise these extraordinary stories that make up who we are as a nation.
So you and Vanessa have been together for a very long time now.
23 years.
Really?
23 wonderful years. We're still in the honeymoon. Yeah.
So Vanessa is a graduate of NIDA Playwriting, and she is not only a well-known but awarded playwright, and she's done Pawn Cake at Malthouse and Griffin, Darling Oscar at the STC, Checklist for an Armed Robber, which is probably one of her highly regarded, and has won quite a few awards, including the Victorian Premier's Literary Award. Her latest work, A Ghost in My Suitcase, has been commissioned for Barking Gecko this year, which is very exciting. So you're both firmly entrenched in the arts and in some ways share similar crafts. Can you share with us what you have learned over the many 23 years about fostering a working creative as well as a personal relationship, and if you think there are any unique qualities involved there?
That's a difficult question, isn't it? But I can see why you've asked that question. You want to find the key, don't you? That's the key.
Well, I think the aim of this is that there's something for us to take away from your learnings.
We often say to each other, we're not rich, but we have rich lives. And that's kind of our mantra. In a way, we have enough to get by, and we want to do things that we want to do. I see so many people not happy in their work life. I think that, to me, work and life are one of the same thing. I mean, people talk about retirement. I can't fathom what retirement. Mm.
Yeah,
what are you retiring from?
Yeah.
You know what? You know, to me, it all integrates, and I think Vanessa feels the same. Although she would love me to, you know, sort of, I think, compartmentalize a little bit more. You know, I mean, if we go away together somewhere, I will find a way to tie that into some kind of, you know, work yeah. thing. And she goes, can we just be on holiday together? You know, and I get the need for that. But at the same time, to me, it's all integrated. And I think it is the same for Vanessa as well. I mean, she's constantly, she will tell this story about being, you know, it's not all been plain sailing, let me tell you. It's peaks and troughs. But, you know, at her lowest point when she thought, you know, oh, I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to go be a midwife and learn to do that. And then she sort of took herself off to the cinema and she kind of went, oh, I've just gone back to narrative. That's what I've done. I've gone back to story. I mean, of course. So, you know, I know that Vanessa sort of is constantly looking for that. She is a great. We're very different. We are very. You know, we are yin and yang. I'm a Sagittarian who will seize anything and just go see the best in everything and go out and, you know, blindly, optimistically blunder my way through. And she will roll her eyes and be much more tentative. But I think it's a really great balance because I think. You know, I've pushed Vanessa into doing things that she would otherwise not have done. And she has certainly made me take stock of some of the stupid things. it's a very lovely balance, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a very keen observer of which is what you want in a writer.
In a writer, absolutely.
What you want in a photographer, you want to forget a photographer's in the room. Yeah. You know, a documentary photographer, you know, you forget the camera's there. Yeah. And people who have got that ability to do that is great. And Vanessa's very much like that. She can just quietly absorb. I remember my mother saying of Vanessa when she met her, you know, 23 years ago, I've got to be very careful about what I say about around you, don't I, Vanessa, because you don't forget anything. You know? Sort of absorbs, you know, which is a great quality to have, but very respectful. And I think you touched on this before, Lauren, about this idea of when you take story, how you get the balance, because a lot of people can take story and be proprietary about that and say, okay, this is my story now, and I don't give a fuck about what I've, how you might feel about how I refine this story. Vanessa, it's incredibly respectful. She has a beautiful quality, and I use this analogy to describe Vanessa sometimes. If we go to a party, if it was a party for Vanessa and there were 50 people there, if there was 20 people there, however many were there, and one person was sitting in the corner not looking engaged, Vanessa would gravitate towards that person and have the conversation there. Everyone else is celebrating, you know, and that's the quality that she has, which is beautiful. Yeah. And I would just go, that's my party. What are you doing? Get out. You're not going to have a fun.
So I think this is a great time for us to really get stuck into talking about Renew Newcastle. And this is such a passion for you, Nick, and particularly as someone who's just arrived in Newcastle. So I might handball to you for this one.
Yeah, of course. So Renew Newcastle was one of those really positive things for me. And it was one of those things that I ticked off on the list of going, yeah, I could totally live in this city. And the project's fantastic. And you are the general manager of Renew Newcastle, Christopher. It's a not-for-profit organisation that aims to activate dormant spaces within the Newcastle region and allow creatives basically a space to explore ideas. Now, it's a transformative idea, yes, and it was originally conceived by Marcus Westbury, who people might know, I believe he is now looking after the Collingwood Arts Precinct in Melbourne, but he's also pretty well known for a book called Creating Cities, and he's a bit of a guru when it comes to urban renewal projects. And in his book, there's a paragraph within that book that I really wanted to share because I think it really sums up what Renew Newcastle does. Now, I have paraphrase slightly, so forgive me please, Marcus, but here it is. Newcastle was dying. Everywhere I looked, the rot was worse than I remembered. Streets that in my memory were vibrant, active, and filled with family and friends had fallen into disrepair and despair. On a walk, I counted 130 empty buildings. What if the problem was not that no one wanted to do anything, but those that wanted to, for whatever reasons, couldn't? I gradually got sucked into asking why the city wasn't working for people like us and how it might be made to work. So, there it is. The concept is brilliant. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about what you see the project as, Christopher, and I guess how it's coming to life in Newcastle, as well as its work across Australia and globally.
I think, yeah, and I talk about this a lot. Now, I came into Renew when it was 4 years old, 5 years old, I think. And when it started, it was I mean, that's a very good, you know, I'm glad you read that from Marcus. I think it's exactly what it was. I often say it's 150 projects, the properties that he counted, but perhaps it was only 130. I'm sure he said 150, but still, there was 20 he missed, but you know, there was certainly a lot.
It's hard to count once you get to 100, you start again.
It was very opportunistic to start with, you know. It was, I know, from Marcus's perspective, this is, you know, he knew arts people here. He grew up here. He grew up here. He'd started This Is Not Art Festival. Yeah. That's what Marcus had done. So he knew a lot of creative people here. And he knew they were working from sunrooms, from spare rooms, from garages. And here was all these empty buildings in the city that was dead. It was, let us just, is there a way we can match these empty spaces with these creative people? And I think really it was about, that would be good for the creative people. It wasn't all these knock-on effects that we've seen happen that the city's come to life. I mean, they weren't necessarily on the agenda at that time. Yeah. They were sort of the accidents of you know, getting this up and running. But so, yeah, completely opportunistic, as artists are. I mean, we are. We do this. We've seen this over the world over. We look at the way places become gentrified very quickly. Artists, you know, make a place attractive. And then it gets gentrified and then they get moved out. The place becomes dull. Often, you know. And so, you know, here's a very rare situation where you've got a whole city that's a blank canvas. I think in the early days, it was very obvious what needed to be done, what the opportunity presented an artist with a space to carry out their idea. But the city was dead and empty. And so in order to get people to come and support the work of the artist, obviously you need to get people in the city. So that's where this idea started, that this is actually an urban renewal process. And people would come in and, you know, these buildings had been closed for 10 years or more, some of them, and they were dirty. There was, you know, cosmetic stuff largely that needed to be done. I mean, that's all we really tackled. Yeah. We couldn't really tackle structural stuff because that was, you know,
heritage
and too problematic. But it was very clear that you needed to come in, roll your sleeves up, get the mop out, get a paintbrush out and a roller, and make this place funky, you know. Yeah. Where we've come now is that there's a lot happening in the city. I mean, like, I think it's fair to say that Renew Newcastle kick-started the renewal in Newcastle. Yeah. Now, these aren't my words. These are the words that other people keep saying, and it's better when other people say it because, you know, if you say, you know, blowing your own trumpet, you know, it sounds a bit hollow. It's but you know, I'm quoting other people who say this, and I, you know, I concur that it did create this this interest. If you see any media about Newcastle over the last 5 years, it will mention the creatives and Renew Newcastle. Now, I've got to be very clear about this. Renew Newcastle is a very small organisation that runs, look, I'm the only full-time employee. We have a few other contractors and the team is formidable, but, you know, it's the equivalent of, I think, about just 2.5 full-time positions that the organisation supports at the moment. It's probably only 1.5. But it's a lean organisation. But what makes up Renew is the 260 projects that we've enabled over the 9 years that we've been going. They are Renew. So this is when I come back to the enabling thing. Now, I already felt I was an enabler before I came and took on the role. But, you know, it is, if someone's got an idea, how can we help you realise that idea? And if it's an idea that's going to fail, that's okay. How, you know, fail and fail quickly and fail cheaply, you know, because failure is not supported enough in the world that we live in. And so, as I said, these are the knock-on effects that happened, as, you know, from that opportunism of matching an artist with a vacant space. Mm-hmm. We have created this place where you can try stuff, you can experiment with stuff, and you can experiment with the community. Now, for me, it's really important that you do experiment with the community. It's not just about putting somebody in a space. Activation, participation, two key words with Renew. If you don't pay rent, you pay a participation fee. To participate means that you are part of something, and the something that you're a part of is collaborating with other like-minded people, but also collaborating with the community and engaging with the community. At the same time, I would also say that to our people, your audience is not here. Your audience is the rest of the world. You know, if we just look at Newcastle as a small, it is, relatively small enclave, And there's always this rivalry between Melbourne and Sydney. I'm from Western Australia. I know parochialism. I grew up there in the 70s and 80s. And when, you know, it was the most isolated city in the world. And, you know, God, we used to talk about over East. Yeah, and this. Yeah, yeah. I see a lot of similarities between Perth in the 70s, 80s and Newcastle now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So I think that what we need to do is, and it comes back to my conversation before about culture and cultural identity. You know, Vanessa, when we moved up here, was worried about moving to Newcastle because she felt she was going to lose her connections in the city. You know, I don't want to move back to Newcastle. She's from here, you know. I don't want to. I'm worried about what that's going to mean. I don't really want to work in Newcastle. I said, well, you know, you're not coming in here to work as a playwright with people in Newcastle. Yes, you might do that, but that's not your purpose. You're actually going to work, you know, use this as a base for the rest of the world. And she laughed at that. Mm. But within 6 months of us being here, she had a play that was being workshopped in New York. And so she went off to New York with this play. And I said, you know, there you go, that's what I'm talking about. And for then, she hasn't looked back. Now, I use that analogy because I think that's really similar to what I'm saying to the people who are working in the Renew spaces. You know, look at the way technology is. It connects us to the rest of the world. I think that one of the reasons that people like yourself are interested in coming here is because we're living in a world now where we are connected globally, and you can almost live anywhere. We don't need to live in a great big city like Sydney where it's impossible to get around and it's, you know, expensive and prohibitive.
Rent's expensive.
I think this is why, you know, Newcastle has now become attractive because of the likes of, you know, the enterprises that have been encouraged through an initiative like Renew. There are others, but therein lies an opportunity that's been created for people to come here and engage with the rest of the world. Yeah. And from that, you know, you said that Renew has, it's been the biggest cultural export for Newcastle over the last 10 years.
You said it was coming to Melbourne, is that right?
Well, the model has been replicated in 39 towns and communities around Australia and 9 international.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think Newcastle really knows that. That how it's like anything, you know, you do something in a place and people, oh yeah, bloody Renew. Yeah. You know, but they don't realise that the attraction,
the
that
far reaching effects the
pull
of that,
that's
yeah.
had in other places. I mean, it's been extraordinary. I get calls on a weekly basis from places around Australia, but also places around the world. You know, people emailing saying, love this, you know, we want to write about this I'm from the, you know, UK in Cambridge and I want to, you know, write this thesis on this. Yes, we can talk about that because it has, you know, had an impact.
Yeah. And so if we bring it back to locally and we look at the 260 projects that have taken place in Newcastle so far, if we look specifically at a new project, which is very exciting and part of the Renew Newcastle affiliation, is the Newcastle train station, which due to the new inner city light rail construction had been left dormant. And it's an amazing old precinct. And of course, you have had the unique opportunity of offering up to 18-month leases for a site that sits proudly in the heart of Newcastle to artists. And it has the apt project name of Platform 4. Can you tell us a little bit about what to expect and what you hope comes from the community and this space?
The station closed in Boxing Day 2014 and sat empty for, you know, 3 years. And for us, that's exactly what we want to prevent. You know, empty building, we could have used it. It would have been great to have that in those 3 years. What has happened to Renew in the last 18 months is we've seen cranes go up in the sky. And there's a perception in the city now that Renew is done. It's finished. It's achieved its purpose. And people, because the cranes are there, I say people are stargazing. Mm. They're looking up and they go, oh, it's all happened. You know, it's all happening, you know. But the reality of what's happening at the ground is there's mass disruption, as there is with any change in a city. And we're seeing the biggest number of vacancies that we've seen since the time I've been in Newcastle, because people are moving out because rents aren't coming down. In fact, rents are, if anything, being inflated a little prematurely, I would say. And the disruption because of all this work. You've seen this happen in Sydney with the light rail and George Street. And these projects take a long time to build. You know, it's 2.5 years to put this infrastructure in. Coupled with that, we've had a big supercars race that's been massively disruptive in the city. And so we're seeing this decline. But we weren't getting traction as Renew. We were saying, look, we can work with this disruption, work with this. And the hard thing is getting property owners to see the value in this Renew Newcastle initiative. The reality is we've done some economic modelling that shows that the big beneficiaries of the Renew Newcastle model are the property owners, because we are custodians of a building when we're there. We're in there. You don't have to pay for security because we're there. If you've got somebody activating a building, you're not going to have the vandalism. You're not going to have the break-ins. You know, it's a place is going to be kept fresh. If there's a leak in the roof or the pigeons get in, you contact the property owner and you let them know, alert them to that, and they can come and take the measures. But if the building is just sitting there idle, it is so vulnerable. Obviously, the train station, the state government, who are the custodians of that, did not want to see that happen. And they put this out to tender and we applied and they gave it to us to be the ones who manage it. And that seems to make a lot of sense. It's a temporary activation. They only want us there for 18 months. And the reason for that is, you know, that's when the light rail will be finished. That's when a lot of the apartments that are being built in the city will be completed. There will be a change of the way this city sees itself. We've seen that change being implemented ever since BHP closed in 98, and the city had to reinvent itself as a lifestyle city. We've been part of that reinvention, of course, you know, with the creatives. It's funny that you sell a city as being a creative city, but then if you don't support the creatives there and they get moved out to the fringes, and we see the classic regentrification model, then that's not really helpful. But the station opportunity couldn't have come at a better time, as I think I said in my story to start with, simply because I felt that if we didn't have a major project, then perhaps it would be time to close Renew. And there's no problem with closing Renew. We don't have an issue with that, as long as the work has been done. But with all this other disruption and the vacancies going there, that would have been a crying shame,
I think.
I think we will be called upon again. Cities never finish evolving. They are always evolving places. I mean, you've read Marcus's book. He talks about this a lot. Cities continue to evolve all the time. Just because you build something shining and new, it doesn't mean to say it's not going to, you're not going to have to retrofit it. It's about the people and how the people use a city. The station, I think, provides us a great opportunity to collaborate and consult with the community. And this is what we're doing with the station. At the moment, we're saying, you know, we're not going to be there till June. So we've got till June to decide who is going to come in and be part of that. What do you want to do in this city, in this space? This is a public, this is a station. This belongs to the city. So if you've got an idea, come and talk to us and we'll see if we can help you realize that idea. I don't want to do that idea. I don't want to manage that idea. Renew is not the ones who are going to do that. You're the one who's going to do it. But if you've got the idea, bring it to us and we'll try and help you realize that idea. That's the beauty of the station.
Yeah.
And the beauty for us as well is Renew Newcastle works, up till now, has worked on a 30-day rolling license. So we are custodians of that building until the property owner has another use for the building. They get a better offer, a commercial lease, or they decide they want to redevelop it. So it's a 30-day license that everyone, those 260 projects, have all signed a 30-day participation agreement, and they may get asked at any time given their 30 days notice. Now, that's a big risk that you will take, but 260 projects have come forward and say, yes, we're prepared to take that risk.
We're willing to do it.
To go there. Now, some of those projects, yes, they ran for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, but others only did the 1 or 2 months before they got their notice. In the station, we've got 18 months. Great opportunity for us, I think, to manage that, oversee that, and enable people to make this a destination.
I really love hearing you talk about it. It has been so lovely to talk, especially about Renew Newcastle, but then also about your career, because I guess when we originally reached out, it was about Renew, but then to see you had this amazing full acting career, it was just such a fantastic bonus. And I guess as a bit of a final question to you, you look at this podcast, you know, we're all about affecting change as artists. You're at a point in your career where you're literally doing that day to day. And there's probably a lot of artists and people out there who want to be affecting more change in their community, in their art, in their careers, whatever it might be. So I guess I wanted to pick your brain and just see what are the tips that you would give to them to help them get started in getting involved in their local community and making a difference.
It's interesting being here in Newcastle. People talk a lot. There's a lot of talk, Gunner. I'm going to do this, we should do this, you know, they should do this, you know. I think with Renew,
8 years ago, we kind of politely excused ourselves from a lot of very worthy conversations about what could happen, the potential for this city. And we kind of said, look, you know, this is great. Continue talking, but we're just going to go and do some shit. and Renew Newcastle happened. And I think there's a great mistake that we make about saying, I'm going to do this. And I've done it. I'm guilty for doing this. You know, we all do it, I think. You know, but just do it. Just get out there and do stuff. Find a way to do stuff. I mean, that's the beauty of an organisation like Renew, because I want to hear from people who want to do it. You want to do that? Okay, how are you going to do that? How can we do that? You know, and so make stuff happen. I know that's very easy to say. I think that was probably a lot easier back in the day. I said I lived in a warehouse in the 80s and we ran a theatre company from there. Yeah, look, I was paying $160 a week for that warehouse in Surry Hills and, I was living on the dole. You can't do that now. And rents are so much higher. I know it's the playing field is very different. Survival is, you know, how do you keep the balance and the tension around those things? You know, we come back to improvising, you know, which actors we do, and I've got much better at it. I was crap at it, I think, when I was in my early days. I used to hate it. I mean, and hence clinging to the script. But the more I was going to say, don't prepare for something, I think the more authentic it is and the more exciting it is to play out. And that's scary.
To discover what you're capable of.
Yeah, and I'm not saying be unprepared. I am prepared, but I'm not going to agonise over, you know, gee, we're doing a podcast today, what am I going to say? And I think that's a way to live. It's the yes and philosophy again. What are you going to do? Don't just talk about it. Do it. You know, you want to do a show? You want to start a theatre company? Start a theatre company. You know, find a way to make that happen. But ask yourself, why are you doing it? You know, have purpose. Don't just do something because, oh, it's a great opportunity for me as an actor, developer, as an actor or an artist, you know. What do you want to say? And what's your market? You know, we live in a world where you can reach out to globally, you know. If you're an actor, you know, are you going to film it and put it on YouTube? Are you going to, you know, if you're going to do it, a show in Newcastle, don't just do it for Newcastle. Make it a world premiere and take it to Melbourne and Sydney or anywhere else, you know. But think beyond the immediate. I think that's the key, you know. Think big.
I absolutely agree with you. We love doing this. We love connecting to individuals and sharing artistic knowledge and hopefully empowering people to create change in their own careers. But what else can we be doing? And if it was completely big picture, what would that look like? So much of what you've said today rings really true for me, and it's just a gift to sit here and talk to someone who has so much experience in the industry and has achieved so much. So a massive thank you for that. We've got some meetings this afternoon. I'm really excited to take this into what we're planning to do next. So thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
So, Lauren, what were your thoughts on that chat with Christopher?
What a fantastic chat. It is always really inspiring. Do we do this every month? But speaking to people who are creating art, that sounds so silly.
Not at all.
But, you know, every time we speak to someone, you find the things about their processes that you really relate to and really resonate with you on your own journey.
Yeah.
And one of the big things for me is Christopher's view on being an enabler.
Yes.
That's something that is very close to my own heart.
Definitely.
I just love how he talks about this idea of, first of all, figuring out what it is that a person wants and then finding a way to collaborate to bring that thing to life.
Yeah. And isn't that lovely? And I feel like that's something that every artist should have a part of that within them. That idea of collaboration is based in the idea that you're helping to enable the person you're working with or the group that you're working with, right?
It's actually interesting. This just occurs to me. I was speaking to someone at an event I went to yesterday and we were having a conversation about that old idea of how important it is to not compare yourself to other people on your journey, and also advice for how to not do that. And it just occurs to me now while we're talking about this that idea of how do I help this person get to where they want to be is a really perfect way to do that.
Yeah, it's a mindset shift, really, isn't it?
It's not, why am I not in a place that I want to be? How can I help other people get where they need to be? And I think in doing so, I think Christopher is a perfect example of this. In doing so, you will get where you want to be on your own creative journey.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you've put that into a mindset shift in regards to, from, you know, rather than thinking of it as being jealous of someone for where they're going, and it might not be even that conscious of a thing, to be able to change that thought process to be something that's a much more positive energy is a great thing. And I think that that really relates to my takeout in regards to, I loved what he said around failing cheap and failing fast. I think it's so easy to be trapped in this mindset sometimes, especially when you're making your own work or doing your own projects, to be able to go, oh my Lord, this is a massive process. This is going to take me forever. Where do I even start? You know, I've got to have a massive budget to do this. Well, no, you don't.
Yeah.
And I think that you can find out what you're good at or find out the projects that you really want to be working on by getting out there, failing cheap and failing fast, and just getting it done.
Yeah.
That's what I love.
Yeah.
And that there's a freedom in that.
Yeah, it's funny, particularly having had our conversation last month where we talked about our takeaways from the podcast, and there's definitely a very strong theme for you about putting this idea of failure in a really positive, motivating light.
Yeah.
Recently, I was chatting in a group, and I was speaking to actress Ellen Fenwick, and she referred me to an article by a writer called Kim Liao. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And the idea of setting rejection goals and actually aiming for 100 rejections a year.
That sounds horrendous.
And I'm like, that's fantastic. And Ellen was just telling me how at peace she feels now that she's been able to change her perspective on rejection and really tap into this idea of seeking failure as much as possible. I just thought it was really interesting.
And once again, it's that mindset shift, isn't it? And it goes back to Sue Maslin. The whole idea that she talked about, which we loved so much, was that idea that every no is one step closer to a yes.
Closer, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
So that's lovely.
Oh, I'm definitely feeling fired up for whatever's coming next.
Yeah, and look, Christopher is doing some fantastic stuff, and I'm really excited that I'm in Newcastle and get to witness what's going on with most of his projects. So that's very exciting.
Witness and maybe a little collaboration somewhere there?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. Yeah, there's been chats, definitely. So we'll see what comes of it, and yeah, I certainly wish him all the best with the upcoming projects, especially the train station.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, let's move on to recommendations. Lauren, what have you got for us?
I've got a bit of a great recommendation this month. I just wanted to talk about recently.
You always bring great recommendations. There's no run-of-the-mill recommendations from you, Lauren.
What I wanted to talk about was recently I was in touch with Priya Namana at Polyglot Theatre. Now, I'm not sure how aware you are of Polyglot's work, Nick.
Semi-aware.
But Polyglot is an amazing collaborative creator of interactive and participatory theatre for children and families, working on contemporary arts experiences for children from babies up to 12 years old.
Wow.
And among many other fantastic projects that Polyglot is responsible for, Priya is running a community film club program through Kids at Risk, which is designed around transition and building resilience. Now, the kids got to choose the artistic medium that they would be working in to tell stories, and they went with film. And so the program is now in its second year of funding from Polyglot. Mm. And it is such a great initiative helping kids to develop storytelling through film at school, but it also allows them to discover why connecting with film and the arts is important, and also to frame their own experiences of the world through the social context of film. Mm-hmm. And the project and everything else that Polyglot is up to is so aligned with the act of storytelling principles, or our beliefs in the power of art to create change, that I just wanted to mention it.
Yeah.
So the website is polyglot.org.au if you want to check out what they're all about. And hopefully we can share more about this amazing project in the coming months.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love this. It has a real parallel to what I've spoken about previously on the podcast, which was when I was at school, there was a wonderful program called Machismo that pretty much did exactly this. And it was about developing storytelling through film, allowing you to connect to the process of making a film. And that singular experience really helped me on my journey to become an actor and producer. So I think these things are really important to get kids young, experiencing the world of artistic creation and having fun with it at an early age, because I think that's so important, rather than coming to it too late and not understanding, I guess, the building blocks of what makes a good film, what makes a good story, all these things. They're so important. And also
that idea of working out your own voice as
and
an
that's
individual.
What I was about to say, even your own voice and I guess understanding the societies that you live within. Yeah, really cool project by the sounds of it.
Yes. And what about you, Nick? Have you got any recommendations?
I do, actually. I've got a couple that are worth noting. Can I just reel these off really quickly? First of all, since we've got a bit of a Newcastle-themed podcast, I thought I'd shout out to the Newcastle Fringe, which is pretty exciting, isn't it? There's a Fringe Festival here in Newcastle, and it's happening from the 21st to the 25th of March. So by the time this podcast is out, it's going to be in the month of March, and there's around about, I think, 100-plus shows, which is really cool, and hopefully that goes from strength to strength. So if you are up in Newcastle, 21st to 25th of March, get along and check out a few shows at the Newcastle Fringe.
That's great. And fringe festivals can be such a great cultural part of a city's identity.
Yeah, it's a direct connection to the artist, because it's usually the artist producing, and it's usually coming from their voice rather than a collective, I guess. So that's a really raw way to watch theatre and experience art. So get along, check out Newcastle Fringe.
And what's your second recommendation for the month?
Lightning Jar Theatre. Good friends of the podcast, doing Venus in Fur. And that is coming up shortly too, Lauren Bailey. It's happening from the 9th of March to the 24th of March at 45 Downstairs, that wonderful little venue in Melbourne.
Yes, it's such a great space. And I am looking forward to getting along myself to see the Lightning Jar Theatre team in action in just a few days' time.
Yes, and knowing the cats that are involved with that, it's going to be great.
Fantastic. And how are things looking in the world of Nicholas Cain for the month ahead?
Yeah, Lauren, so the month ahead, fully into this routine idea that I spoke about up front, I think there's really a couple of focuses for me for the month ahead. One, obviously, is acting. So just continuing the process of travelling to Sydney, auditioning, working on my craft, finding some classes up here in Newcastle.
Great.
Part two of the focus, I guess, is making my own work. So there is a film I've been talking about a lot. I have got off my ass and I have created a deadline for this film now. So that's an exciting thing when you've got that
we
little
should talk.
Yeah, I'll keep you in suspense for a little bit longer. And then finally, another thing that's been happening a little bit, I've been hosting a lot of gigs recently. And it's funny how sometimes these things happen in clusters. Like, you know, I'd hosted maybe one or two gigs last year. This coming month, there's four things that I'm hosting, which is kind of cool, you know, and it's people approaching me. So it's really exciting to see what's going on there, I guess. You know, it's fun to do things like that and to change up your, you know, your, what's the word I'm looking for here, Lauren Bailey?
Routine.
Thank you for listening to what I've been talking about. So yeah, that's going to be fun. So they're really the focuses for the next month ahead. What about you?
So as I mentioned, I on the other side of the interview, I'm feeling really focused about what I'm putting out into the world at the moment. Mm-hmm. So there's three things. And the first one is, of course, my acting, refreshing my promotional portfolio at the moment. I'm also starting rehearsals shortly for a remount of Cuckoo at the North Melbourne Meat Market in April, which will be up as a double bill with the Baker's Dozen production of Mike Bartlett's Cock, which is directed by the wonderful Ben O, and, you know, just all the other business as usual bits and pieces that comprise the life of an actor. I'm also very focused on writing for the development of the series for In Life Today, which is having some exciting progress. And my third focus is, of course, working my way toward my scary end of year goal of creative financial freedom.
I love that. Creative financial income. It sounds like you've become an accountant and you're throwing these Christmas parties. Oh, very good. We did miss one thing, Lauren, that I wanted to mention that maybe you could put on the end.
Did I?
Is maybe just put on there Oscars 2019. How do we get there?
Of course, right.
You know, like I'm just very disappointed there was a lack of Lauren Bailey and Nick Cane at the Oscars. Even if it looks like at the moment I could just replace Jimmy Kimmel as the host. That, you know, that's a starting point.
Well, I still have a goal of a filming competition at the Cannes Film Festival, so maybe that could be our way in.
Yeah, I almost don't care how we get there, Lauren. I think we just have to get there. It's my...
Well, let's get cracking on that. I'm very keen for us to figure this out.
Yes.
And so that, of course, brings us to the end of another great podcast. And while we are both busy working on our plan for the Oscars 2019, please feel free to head over to theactorstorytelling.com.au to check out any of the awesome podcasts from our back catalogue.
And if you want to get in touch with us, please do. Hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, at ACTStorytelling. Or via the email, which is theactofstorytelling@gmail.com.
Yes. Thank you, as always, for listening to the podcast. You're all part of Nick and my own creative journeys, so thank you. A massive shout-out to the fantastic Anita Quayle for her wonderful Taos theme music and everyone else who has helped us along the way.
So, you know, just continue to join us on The Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening.
Melbourne's Podcast Network. Earbudsnetwork.com.